It's time for Inside LCC, an inside look at Lansing Community College's academic programs. We've got you covered with programs that nourish creativity and exploration, cultivate your purpose, and guide you to your career. Listen as we explore some of the opportunities at LCC and learn from conversations with faculty members, staff, and students.
Hello, I am Melissa Kaplan, and I am delighted to be here in the studio today with the lead faculty for the geology program, Kirsten Wright. Welcome, Kirsten.
Thank you, Melissa.
I'm really excited to learn more about geology and share with our listeners all the possibilities for studying it here and also what they might do once they have studied it here at LCC. So, first of all, tell me a little bit, how long have you been with LCC?
I've been teaching here at LCC for about 10 years.
Wonderful.
And I've always loved teaching, and I love the opportunity to teach and share with students. Prior to teaching here, I worked in environmental remediation, so we worked on contaminated sites. I study a lot of the data, and we put together plans to clean them up.
Wow. Was that like industrial sites or residential?
It was a lot of industrial sites, both in Michigan, across the U.S., and even a few globally.
Wow. That's a huge job.
Yes. Yeah. I ran a lot of the data and data analysis, and it was a really fun job to do and rewarding to know that we were cleaning stuff up. But it's even more rewarding now that I'm teaching and seeing students learn.
That's really wonderful. And it's interesting, and we can come back to this because I'm intrigued about your background in geology and then that job, which says to me that somebody with a background in geology can do all kinds of things.
Absolutely. When people hear about geology, they think just rocks. And I do have a lot of fun with rocks.
Yes, you do.
But it's also earth processes. It's contamination stuff. So career opportunities are really everywhere. There's a lot in the petroleum industry, but there's also a lot in the environmental industry, both advocating and in cleanup.
So you said people think about rocks when they think about geology, and I sure do. And I think about layers of rocks, and I think about things like petrified forests. Tell me a little bit, how would you define geology for somebody who may be intrigued but doesn't know that much about it, but maybe thinking, this could be something I want to study?
Well, geology is literally the study of the earth. That's what the word is made up out of. So there's a lot of processes that we study, how the rocks form, but also things like how rivers work, their deposits, and how they move water around and carve out valleys, volcanoes, earthquakes, everything that happens on the earth.
So within the earth and outside the earth, such as glaciers as well.
Yes.
Whereas the atmosphere is probably another science, the study of the atmosphere.
Atmosphere we only look at as far as how it interacts with some of the physical parts of the earth, but it's also very dynamic when we talk about contamination as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, and we know how the earth changes, but at the same time, day to day, many people probably just think of it as the substantial thing that I exist on, and yet it is so dynamic.
It is. On a day-to-day basis, we don't see many changes, but when you start to look through years or start to look into the history, the earth really is very dynamic and ever-changing.
Yeah. So tell me a little about the program here at LCC.
So the program here at LCC, we have a geology degree that would lead students through the first 2 years of intending them to transfer into a four-year program. Most jobs in the geology or environmental industry would need a bachelor's. So we've assembled things for students to know what they would need to take, and also some interesting things in that area, which would lead them into a four-year. Also, we have a conservation and sustainability degree program, which is very similar in that it mostly leads students into a four-year program. And the conservation and sustainability includes a lot of biology as well as some of the physical things that geologists work with. And there's a lot of different directions that sustainability can go through.
So what are some of those directions?
The biologists would better speak to that.
Okay.
I have that physical perspective.
That's interesting that it's within geology, but yet it kind of crosses the disciplines.
It very much does cross the disciplines. So as a geologist, the microbes have an influence, and that's biology. A lot of ecosystems are more biology than geology. And so ecosystem management like wetlands and advocacy groups for some of our ecosystems, either in Michigan or outside of Michigan, a wider perspective too.
That makes sense. Has that increased in interest, the conservation and sustainability?
Absolutely, yes. The conservation and sustainability is a very much an increasing industry, and our students have a lot of interest. Whether they want to go into sciences or not, a lot of students place a lot of importance on taking care of our planet, and understanding our planet and how things work is really a big first step.
I'm really glad to hear that. Yeah. So what kind of classes, for example, in conservation and sustainability, what are some of the classes that students would be taking?
A lot of it's a broad base. So a year of just about each of the sciences. So a year of biology, a year of chemistry. We throw in some geology, and also physics is a good one to take, having some foundation in math. Mm-hmm. A couple of extras that are really good skills to start building are things like our geospatial program as well.
What's that?
Some people think drones. Some
okay.
think of, you know, like the satellite system that drives our phones. But also we can use that spatial analysis to look at our data and to understand how things are working. When I worked in environmental remediation, I did a lot of spatial data analysis, and the GIS skills, so geographic information systems, those skills I used a lot of. So it's good to have in your back pocket.
What's spatial analysis?
Spatial analysis, one really good example is we had a contaminated site that we took a lot of samples from. And when...
What was it contaminated with? Do you know? Or is that what you were investigating?
We were investigating. Mm. And it was contaminated with so many things that I can't even say.
Wow.
So that was one of the challenges with the site. When we had a sample that had a high concentration of, say, a volatile organic carbon, those are the things that can evaporate as well, then we needed to know where that location was. And that demanded a certain remediation system.
Oh.
If a location had a lot of heavy metals in it, that demands a different remediation system. So then taking those samples and the data from them, comparing them to criteria to see what exceeded, which would have been hazardous to people, plotting those onto maps so that then we can start to analyze where those contaminants are and how to address them. That's a lot of spatial analysis.
I see. So multi-layered effort. Wow.
Yes.
So in geology, what kind of classes would students at LCC expect to take?
So in geology, we have three geology classes. Two of them are very much part of a full bachelor's program. We have physical geology and historical geology. Our third class that's available, and I would encourage any geology student to take, is also environmental geology. We put more spin and more focus on the interaction of people and earth systems, both our effect on the systems and the systems' effect on us. And then in a geology degree program, those students are also going to take a year of chemistry, a year of physics, and a year of biology. And then when they move on to a four-year university, they're going to start taking more specialty courses like in sedimentary rocks and igneous rocks, minerals, and some specialty things.
So here they're getting a nicely rounded foundation in the sciences, as well as a little bit of specialization in geology, and then they move on to really focus on geology at a four-year.
You got it, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds great. I know we have all of our science programs are really, really solid. So as far as transferring, where are some of the schools that our students decide to transfer to?
Quite a few of our students go to MSU. I did both my undergraduate and graduate studies at MSU.
Well, hello, fellow Spartan.
Awesome. Go green.
Go white.
Michigan Tech also has a fantastic geology program.
What a great place to study. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with right around here in the Lansing area, but boy, in the UP, that's rich, isn't it, as far as geology access?
There's a lot of sites within a short distance up at Michigan Tech. Here in the Lower Peninsula, Western Michigan University also has a very strong program. They house the Michigan Geologic Survey, along with several educational programs. And interestingly enough, Lake Superior State up in Sault Ste. Marie, they're a small college, but they have a very strong geology program. That's where I was able to launch out of with a field trip with other earth science teachers this past summer. And we had some fantastic experiences.
I want to know about that. And also, for those of you who are watching the vidcast of this program, you're going to get to see some cool things that Kirsten has brought in, some really cool rocks. For those of you who are listening, we'll try and describe them to you. So tell me about that field trip. And then also, let's do a little show and tell here.
Yeah. So that field trip caught interest out of, we went to the MSTA conference. MSTA is Michigan Science Teachers Association, and there's a subgroup of Michigan Earth Science Teachers. They lead several field trips, and they gave us opportunity we went up to the north side of Lake Superior, and we collected and saw a lot of rocks off of the bedrock up there. Including the key interest was one of the latest collecting crazes called uprolites.
Uprolites?
Yes, uprolites is the fun name. It's made out of a rock. The base name is syenite, which is not so familiar, but most people know of granite. Granite is a rock that we see in a lot of buildings and countertops and tile. And syenite is just like granite, except it lacks quartz. So it's actually even a little bit more boring, if you want to show that to everybody.
So this is syenite right here?
That is syenite.
Okay.
And it's got a little bit less sparkle than granite. It starts out, a lot of people think, a little bit boring.
Like this side here is not quite as flashy as the other side. But I can see on the side here, you know, like when you think of granite countertops and kitchens, that right there looks a little bit like that, the pink and the black.
It does. We see the speckles of different colors. The cool thing about uprolites, though, is that there's some sodalite in it, and that sodalite's normally blue, but we don't see blue. The sodalite has been altered. The crystal structure's just a little bit tweaked enough that it fluoresces. And if we put UV light onto it, it fluoresces this very brilliant orange color.
Oh my gosh, and that's so cool.
Thank you. I've been very excited about these rocks. If you happen to talk to me and you bring up anything about this, you might have a long conversation on your hands.
Well, I can see why it's a collecting craze, because now, do people walk around with a flashlight? That's a special flashlight, right?
It is a special flashlight. Yeah. The good flashlights are a little bit pricey, somewhere between $50 and $100.
Okay.
But a flashlight like this one, you can walk along the shoreline and shine it on the rocks at your feet, and these rocks will fluoresce.
Oh, wow. And that, what kind of flashlight is that? What's it called?
It's a UV light.
UV, okay.
So it has an ultraviolet. This one also has a filter. A lot of the ultraviolet bulbs put out some blue light that we can see. Technically, UV is past the spectrum where our eyes can see, and that's what we talk about with fluorescence.
So besides their property of fluorescing, what else is the sort of importance or relevance of these particular combinations of rock?
Not a lot. They are found usually with volcanics, and they cool underground. And the uprolites that we find along the Lake Superior lakeshore, even some along Lake Michigan, they got plucked off by the glaciers and transported down into the Great Lakes by those glaciers. And then when we go back up to the bedrock source, that's alongside of a volcanic complex with both some rocks that cooled underground slowly, and we can see their crystal structure.
Okay.
And then there's also igneous rocks that cooled very quickly during that volcanic activity in deep earth history.
So what else do you have there? You have two other things that are really intriguing to me.
I do have, this one is a piece of native copper.
Heavy.
Native copper can be found mostly in the Upper Peninsula, And it's a pure copper. And it's forms that way and is found that way naturally. So this piece has not been refined or anything like that. It's just simply all the other parts have been weathered away. And then there's this blob of pure copper.
Wow.
We find them kind of commonly as the size of the palm of your hand.
This is a big piece. It's like two hands.
Very much. It is a big piece. And that's why it goes on my personal collection shelf.
Yeah. Yes, and I've been to your office, and you have quite a collection. And then you have another interesting...
And then the final one, during the same field trip, we had opportunity to go to an abandoned copper mine. So in that area, they drilled several holes. They have found copper in places. Other places, they were looking for copper. So there's a special drill bit. When they drill down the hole, it leaves it's hollow inside, and it leaves this rock core.
And wow. We
get a good view of what's underground. This particular piece, the dark brown colors are from a lot of iron, which are heavy in the region. And then also the greenish pieces in that are pieces that were included into rocks underground. The greenish comes from a copper oxidation. Hmm. So that's showing us some presence of copper. That particular rock would not have been a good place to mine the copper out of. But there were other locations on that same piece of property.
Fascinating. Fascinating. It's I could see if somebody had even the slightest inclination. Not that you necessarily will have a job that means you're outside, but there's more opportunity probably to be outside if you are a geologist or in conservation and sustainability than some other fields, you know?
Yeah, the setting for a work environment, there's a lot of variety in both geology and conservation and sustainability. As one of our fellow faculty noted, if you love camping, there's projects where you might be out camping, you know, 10, 30 days during the summer, doing a lot of sampling alongside of it. So if you're that outdoorsy, you can. I've been on sites where we're outside during the day and then back home at night. And then I've also worked on different aspects of projects where I'm behind a computer all day, doing some really cool things like putting spatial data on maps.
That's great. So here at LCC, I want to make sure we have a chance to talk about some of the sort of outside the classroom opportunities that you provide and the collaborations with other disciplines. Do students get a chance to be outside? Do they have projects and are there practical experiences that they gain through the program?
Some of the things that we do within the program is we have a couple of field trips that we take, including out to Fitzgerald Park and Grand Ledge.
Oh, that's a great place with the ledges there.
And then another thing that the science department has been doing is collaborating with both other departments and bringing out our faculty from within our department and some professionals together into what we call meet and greets. And so we had a focus on being a scientist just in general. We brought together students and faculty and advisors and professionals from the science industry and offered an opportunity for students to talk to those people, see what it was like to work in the industry, ask questions of what kind of credentials and skills to do the work that they wanted to do.
That's a great opportunity. Really valuable. And I like that you do it in a sort of informal way across sciences, because starting out, somebody might have a real strong inclination in a particular direction, or they may know that science was an area that they wanted to pursue. So that's really valuable. You also have, I know there's a big project that involves a fossil park.
Yeah, we're trying to put together what we're calling a fossil garden.
Ah, fossil garden.
So it's like a rock garden, but better. We have a source for a very large stone or two that's limestone that's just full of fossils. And then the beauty of these particular rocks is that they are just soft enough that with some effort, you can pull pieces off of it.
So
it's a little bit crumbly, not quite falling apart. And we're going to encourage people to walk in to the fossil garden, step up, find your own fossils, identify some, and maybe even harvest off a piece to keep.
Oh, that's really great. You might have to replenish that if you get a lot of people really interested in taking from the garden, but that's very generous and exciting.
Yeah. The beauty of the idea of the fossil garden is we can bring in other aspects. So it's not just geology. There's history in it. There's biology in it. And then we hope to bring in like maybe some native plants for a more native style gardening. And
yeah, I was thinking horticulture, but then also the indigenous approach to the environment.
Absolutely. We would love to bring in some artistic elements as well. Create just kind of a nice little escape.
Oh, I love that.
And, you know, students are busy. They're heading from class to class. LCC has a lot of study spaces, but a natural space outside that's available to both students, staff, faculty, and the public. It would be fantastic.
I think that's great. You know, our campus, to me, it's a respite. And it's a little, well, like the Shigematsu Japanese garden is this jewel. And so to create more of these little jewels around that welcome people, but also have an opportunity to learn and be used in the classroom is really wonderful. I love that layering of enjoyment and relaxation and learning at the same time.
I agree. I'm really excited about it.
Oh, that's great. That's great. What else would you like to share as we wrap up? And I will include in the show notes, I'll make sure to include links to the program site and your email as well for people who want more information. Anything else you'd like to share?
There is not. I think we've covered it.
We've covered a lot. Other than going outside and doing some remote production while we walk and talk and look at things, we'll save that for another time. But this has really been great. Kirsten Wright with the Geology Program at Lansing Community College. Thank you so much for being on Inside LCC.
And thank you so much for the opportunity, Melissa.
I'm Melissa Kaplan, and thank you for listening to Inside LCC.
This has been Inside LCC. If there's a specific degree and program you want to hear more about, let us know by contacting us at lccconnect.org. Thanks for taking a listen. Inside LCC.
Connecting you with Lansing Community College, this is LCC Connect.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Lansing Community College's downtown and west campuses offer conference and event spaces that can accommodate over 500 attendees. LCC offers hybrid meeting capabilities, in-house catering, free event parking, and on-site customer service. For more information about LCC's conference and event spaces, visit lcc.edu and search conference.
Hey, hon, what you doing with your phone?
Do flowers have best friends?
I don't know.
Hey, look. Whoa.
Some answers can only be found in nature. Discover the unsearchable. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a trail near you. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Lansing Community College welcomes transfer students. Transfer students may apply prior credits toward their LCC degree, certificate, or transfer program. Learn more at lcc.edu/youbelong.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
It's time for Stars on Sports,
a podcast radio show dedicated to sharing stories about our athletic program at LCC, past and present.
Lansing Community College Athletics has a strong tradition.
25 national championships.
Over 190 All-Americans.
19 MCCAA All-Sports trophies.
Stars on Sports will introduce you to individuals that have contributed to our program's success and give you the backstory on what it takes to develop it.
We'll also dive into and break down the topics and issues facing athletic departments across the nation and right here at LCC.
This is Stars on Sports.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Stars on Sports. I'm joined today by our assistant athletic director, Stephen Cutter, and our producer, Dedalian Lowry. We were talking before we got on the air here. As I prepare for these podcasts, there's a lot of topics that I create and then start, you know, branching out with them. And today we're going to talk about competing, but it could go a bunch of different ways because we were talking about a couple other topics before we got on here. I think competing is an important part of our job. And one of the things, again, that it intrigued me that we will also be talking about in the future on a podcast is paradoxes in sports. Because I think there's a lot of things in sports that we talk about that can be taken positively or negatively. And I believe that about competing. But, you know, I was at a luncheon a couple of weeks ago, and the leader, he was an athletic administrator at a high level, and, you know, talked about our goal is to compete, achieve, and grow. I mean, that stuck with me because I think of our mission too, and we're an educational entity and that and student first, but we do compete. And I think some people outside of the world of sports think that as a negative. And also the difference between competing in the world of sport and outside the world of sport. And I'll give you a quick example. Like, my family gets mad at me because I like putting my map on my car little screen there, and it gives me my time to get there.
And you try to beat it.
I do. Mm-hmm. And like, even when I know it, like the direction that at that point, I leave it up there and they get mad at me. Like, we went somewhere this weekend. I could not, it stayed at 12:28 and I was doing and I wasn't breaking the law. I don't drive fast or anything. I mean, maybe five sure. over with the rule, whatever. But I do try to beat it. And I'm a competitor. I mean, I want to, and not necessarily win. I always say be better because competition isn't about winning, really. I mean, I think we confuse that, too. It's about competing. Winning is the result. Some would say it's a mindset, and I believe that. But it helps raise standards. It helps build resilience. It helps create elite environments. So, yeah, I'd like to dive in a little bit about competing. And you and I, last year, spent a lot of time talking about competing, and you brought me on to the North Carolina women's soccer coach.
Anson,
yeah. And how he used competition, and it was very impressive. I mean, he was successful at, 22 national mm-hmm. championships, I think. I mean, North Carolina women's soccer is a dynasty. But how, you know, the competitive cauldron was his thing. And so we'll dive into that, too, but first in things on competing.
Well, I think what I was taught, or maybe what I learned along the way, is it's pretty simple to compete. You just show up.
Interesting. Okay. All right.
I think competing gets a bad rep because of, I'd say, attitude of some people that are competing. And by that, I mean, I think the only thing worse than a sore loser is a sore winner. And that's just my personal perspective.
Very good.
Love that.
Uh-huh.
I think ultimately the most influential way to compete is compete with yourself versus mm-hmm. competing with others. And not only is it influential, but it's also really healthy to not be competing with others, but just competing with yourself.
As you guys were talking about it, that was actually one of the things that I think about myself. I don't think I have a very competitive nature to me, mm-hmm. per se. However, I will say I'm very competitive with myself, and I want to always beat whatever it is that I've done in the past. So, yeah, I'm definitely that way.
And I think that's actually healthier, and I didn't even know where this was going to go, but that's a good perspective. And that might help to your point of, I think you're better at handling the result if you compete with yourself instead of being a sore loser or a sore winner. And I think you become one of those when you put too much emphasis on the result. And I think we do. And that's where I think competing and winning get intertwined, which they are different.
It's also hard, though, because if you're competing with yourself and you fail and you care about it, you are going to be frustrated. And so then that becomes that gray line. Is that a sore loser because you're mm-hmm. frustrated? Mm-hmm. And how far can that frustration go and stuff like that? And that ultimately comes back to people's opinions of it. But if you are seeing people competing, whether it's with themselves or against everybody else that's in the room, you're going to see frustration when failure happens. That you should see it. If they don't care, then that's when you're not going to see the frustration. But if they're competing, they care, you're going to see frustration. It's just those weird gray lines.
If we do focus on the results, you talk about that frustration if you don't compete well. But, you know, you gave me an article a little bit ago is where we need to change the mindset of how we look at not succeeding mm-hmm. and look at it as learning, and instead of judging ourselves that mm-hmm. we failed. And, you know, they gave mm-hmm. an example of a flower. You put a seed down, you don't get mad mm-hmm. at the flower because it's not a flower yet. It has to grow and develop.
And I gave an example a few nights ago in leadership, and it was about a baby that's learning how to walk, but it's crawling. It mm-hmm. doesn't get frustrated at itself because it can't walk yet. It mm-hmm. just keeps working on pulling itself up and eventually taking that first step. And the frustration isn't there. It's more focused on really quite simply just the process, just trying to get a little bit better. And you don't see that frustration because, oh, I can't walk or I can't run. But that gets built into us a little bit. And that's where that comes from.
We're talking about babies here on sport, but I want to dive into that because also
that's where it all starts, brother.
It is, and ends too. That's a good example of what I was trying to say. Babies don't know differently. They don't know they shouldn't be walking or that they should be mad about them for not succeeding. So they're not judging themselves on how they do. They're just getting back up, but they don't care either. So I still believe that's where maybe in athletic that becomes a little more of a part of competing, because I hope you care to be either better yourself or, again, compete against the other team to do well. But the other things I think that are important are competing every day in practice. I think it has to be consistent. I think it has to be at a high standard. I don't think you do better or reach your goals if you don't push yourself and you beat teams that aren't as good as you, that you got to play somebody better or compete against somebody that is similar to you. And I think that's where Coach Dorrance was good at. He had competitive drills every day, and I thought you experimented with that a little bit last year. And I think that is important, that you don't become better shooters by just scrimmaging, you know, but do drills that reward making shots or reward rebounding if you want to work on rebounding. So it's getting creative on trying to award and praise and develop those skills, but there still needs to be competition of those skills, I believe, to get better. I think you start with teaching them fundamentals and that, but then they got to compete to get better. Did you do try some of that competition? Do you still use competition in your practice? I mean, because you studied Coach Dorrance a lot last year, I believe, and you're the one that got him on to me. And again, a lot of coaches use competition, but he had like a manual that.
You study him because success leaves clues.
It does, and his clues were pretty successful for as much as he won. But John Gordon talks about, you know, you got to have a mission, a team, and a scoreboard to be successful. And I think the scoreboard part is the competing part. You know, you got to measure something. I mean, how do you know if you're doing good at something if you're not measuring? And to Dalian's point, measuring against yourself is the best way. If I ran a 10:20 yesterday, 2 mile, and run a 10:19 today, I'm better. But the course might have been harder. The conditions might have been harder.
And that's why he really focused on the details of like how to put your socks on so that you didn't get blisters, and how to tie your shoes so they weren't coming untied and you would have sprained your ankle and things like that. And so it's not all about the results in competing. It's about taking care of the details and trying to get a little bit better or become extremely proficient with whatever it is that you're doing.
And it is, it's habits, it developed habits, it developed consistency, which I know you talk a lot about, but it also helps you, you know, thrive under pressure, I believe, because under competition, there is pressure. I mean, there is not people watching, even if you're watching yourself on trying to be better, there's pressure there. And we've talked about how you handle that. But I think competition helps us deal with that and helps us learn to work under it, which does apply to an exam in class or in life or even driving, the pressure you have of, you know, getting in front of the construction people. But so do think it applies, but it's about practicing it and working on it and keeping it in perspective, which I think is something I don't think we do a good enough now, because like when you think of competition, do you think of a positive or negative?
It's a huge slice of life. So it's positive.
To me, it is positive. Dalian, what do you think? I mean, you alluded to it a little bit at the beginning. Do you think it's a positive term or a negative term?
I mean, overall, I'd say positive. Again, if it's helping you to excel, achieve higher goals, then yeah, it's a positive.
I believe it is too, but I still want to hit on some of the points you mentioned about what it leads to, because it can lead to jealousy. It can lead to division between teammates. It can lead to egos and dealing with those. And I think,
but a lot of times that's for the people that aren't competing is where that's coming from. And sometimes you have to really think about the opinions of those others that aren't competing. And if you're not willing to trade spots with them, then you don't necessarily worry so much about that opinion. And the makeups of teams or business environments, not everybody is going to be competing with themselves. It's somewhat seasonal sometimes. They might be going through a lot of things or whatever it is. There's always stuff going on, but not everybody is competing at the level that some others are competing at. And then there's the ebbs and flows of that team, and it just constantly is changing. But a lot of times the frustration, the jealousy, and that other stuff actually comes from those that aren't doing that.
Right.
Yeah, and I think, again, that's something we deal with regularly, because even on your own team, you have different levels of kids that want to compete. I believe when your best players are your most competitive players, that's when your team's going to be the best. Again, the captain's class, the book we referred to before on this thing, it talks about leader-led teams, but if I generalize that, it wasn't your best player being a leader. It was your most your competitive player, your grittiest player, your player that goes through a brick wall, that plays hurt, you know. And I'm not encouraging those. That I'm just saying that they're, you know, strong will of competition. If more of your team have that, I think it's going to help your team be more successful. Having said that, it's still a balance for a coach to manage all those.
It's not only a balance, but it's the bigger question is, how do you build it?
Again, I believe it's through drill, through constant practice of it. I believe it's consistency, because I think it leads to other, you know, when I talk about the negative side of, you know, different kids don't want to compete and it can create division or egos. But I also can believe it can help neutralize that, because you have metric to show that we're not just playing this person. We're not showing favoritism, that there's metric there to show that this person is out competing you in certain ways. And again, doing those drills where you keep data that helps you show and helps. Again, we talked about Zach Thorne in our last one about how if you take it the right way, it's going to make you better. I mean, again, back to how you handle it, the result is that, you know, you can get frustrated or mad, or you can work harder and get better. And that's, you know, my approach. I like knowing where I'm at and what I have to do, and give me that, you know, battle to go to. And I think those are the competitive people. And those are, again, I hate losing more than I like to win people. Mm-hmm. What about your bowling league? You were in bowling last night. Any competition there, or how that?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny you actually say this stuff today, only because, okay, so one of the things I've been trying to do is I've been trying to get my game up a little bit. And again, competing with yourself can only go so far sometimes. So I have been trying to, and we don't do player versus player in our bowling league, but I've been trying to do this thing where whoever is across from me, I've been trying to outbest them. I don't talk about that. I don't, you know, it's just a personal thing where I go, okay, I'm trying to beat this player. And I pretty much got my butt handed to me last night. So, you know, from that perspective, however, it did help me to at least attain my average 2 out of 3 games.
I think that's a great story, Dedalion, because it does. It gives you something to work towards. It gives you a goal, and it gives you something to measure with.
Growth.
Because I think
it's growth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, compete, achieve, grow. You compete. Do you achieve or not achieve? And you can even, you met your standard, but you didn't beat the other person because they were better. And
I think I did actually win one game, but I think it was actually my worst game that I won that game. So I don't know what to think of that.
Well, I think that's sport. That's why you shouldn't always go on the scoreboard, because, you know, they might have had their worst game too. You know, that's what's fun. So I think that's a great analogy of what competition does. It helps rise your standard. It helps you measure if you did it. How do you know if you achieved or not if you don't have that measure? But
And he also hit on something that, you know, sometimes it's a little bit harder for that to come internally, so you got to turn externally. And that's why it's been said for 100 years, like, it's super important who you hang around or who's around you, and it makes such a enormous difference on growth. And if you're the best player on a team, that's probably not going to be the best team for you to be on, just because if there's not going to be a ton of competition per se, and that same thing applies in the business world.
I think John Maxwell said, if you're the smartest person in the room, find another room.
Yeah, and yeah,
right. You won't, I mean, it won't push you or get better. 100%. And you're right. I'm glad you brought that part up, because that wasn't part of any of my notes about accountability, about, you know, and that's what a team does. And that's what opponents do, is they give you accountability. And we've been big believers on this podcast about having accountability partners. So, but another real quick thing too is, you know, when I think of competitors, the first people I think of are Kobe and Michael Jordan. And as I study more of them, you know, they're all in. You know, that's a characteristic of some of our, like, most competitive people in the past. And again, it could be a strength that becomes a weakness, that they sacrifice a lot of things.
They're hyper-competitive, and not everybody needs to be to those levels. There's extremities with the competitiveness, and you really have to know how to handle it. Otherwise, it's going to spin out of control. And as just you said, the strength to a weakness, it's going to turn into a weakness. And so, yeah, I think you have to be really cautionary when you're speaking about it, whether it's in sports, the Kobes or the Jordans, or in the business world, the Steve Jobs, or, you know, people like that. You have to be somewhat cautionary, because those are extremities, and they were talking, for the most part, they were able to handle that piece of it, but not everybody is able to handle that much extreme locked in competitiveness.
Right.
Well, that's where Bill Jackson gets, you know, their coaches get a lot of credit in managing that competitiveness, because they weren't great teammates at the beginning of their careers because of that. So it is someone managing that competitiveness and dealing with it, because I think that's why it gets a bad rap, because people see the extreme part of it and turns people off, I would say, a little bit. Or one, they're afraid to succeed, so they don't want to put effort into it because there's expectations that go with succeeding, or it's too hard of work.
Yeah, everybody competes, especially in the sports world. Everybody, doesn't matter what team you're on or what, if you're a starter or reserve or whatever, everybody competes. It's just a matter of at what frequency are they competing at.
And I'm going to go a whole another direction here, which doesn't surprise you two, but Darwinism, only the strongest survive. I've always kind of kept that in the back of my mind as a truth of life, you know, that there, I mean, obviously that's a theory out there and a reputable theory, and people utilize it. And I believe that fits in, you know, life is competition. You know, I saw a dumb game show on the other day, like 99 to beat, and it's not about winning. It's about beating that. You're not the last, you know, and you're going to watch it now, Cutter. I don't know if I'll watch it again.
I'm not spending a coin on that.
So, but my point is, you know, people always joke, like, if you're getting chased by a lion, just don't be the slowest person, you know, but there's still competition. And we, again, I think most people focus on winning as competition, but sometimes it's just, you know, being better.
Not losing.
That's right. Not losing. So,
don't be last. Don't be last.
And we do not want to live that way in LCC Stars Athletics. We want to be our best, not just be better than someone else. So I think that's a good way.
So what's the food question for the week?
Yes, I'm glad you asked. So it's not exactly a food question, and it's what
wait. I gotta confess, I'm actually now driving around in my car at times trying to think of food questions to add on just for you, because I know you're getting like at that point where you're like, I don't know what to ask about anymore.
Well, I got it.
Like, it seriously happened to me yesterday, and I was just like, okay,
like
this is ridiculous.
Guy.
This is ridiculous. I'm thinking about food.
One?
No.
Come
no,
on.
No, I've got nothing
come
for you.
On.
Go.
I have a bunch. I don't think they're as interesting as, so this is a common question, and so it's more of, if you could eat dinner with one person, most of them have three or four, but just one today, for who would it be?
Wow.
So
wait, dead or alive?
Doesn't matter. Just one person you, and doesn't have to be like, you know, just someone you'd like to have dinner with, to have that conversation with. I've always had it like, someone's always asked me like the three people I would want to. So I'll start with mine. So it would be John Wooden. I mean, he was always been that coach that I look to. So I would like to talk to him and brainstorm him. It'd be Harry Truman, who's one of my favorite presidents. So I would really like to pick his brain. I've read a lot about him and would like to sit and talk to him. And the other thing interesting is that I learned this from one of my bosses. Like, when we're in a final round of an interview, we usually take the last couple of candidates out to a meal because it like breaks down a barrier and you have a great conversation and you really get to know them better than just sitting across the formal table and asking questions. So, and then there'd be some spiritual leaders in in there too, but, and then I'd take away from the people I do know, like my family or such, they would obviously be first. I love having dinner with my family, but so it'd be a famous coach, John Wooden at this time, it'd be a famous president, which to me, Harry Truman would be that person. So
you got anything already?
Yeah, that's, I mean, you could go a lot of different directions, but I think about like Ken Revisa, he was kind of the, you know, a big piece of the mental game.
Yes. Founder.
I think about Albert Einstein, and I think about my grandfather.
Okay. Why Albert Einstein? What intrigues you about him?
Just curiosity.
Genius. Okay. Okay.
Curious and not afraid of failure.
No, you are right.
So the first one that came to my brain was Salvador Dali.
Okay.
Surrealist painter. And then the second one that actually came to my brain was Nikola Tesla. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
so yeah, kind of the same thing, just to be interesting to pick his brain, get some notions as to where, and to find out what was real and what wasn't really.
Yeah, those are good. And that's neat. And again, those, again, just different compartments of life that you'd want to meet with somebody to talk and learn about. So it's always a good question. It's always an icebreaker.
Add on, just because you mentioned the presidential one, it'd be Abraham Lincoln.
You know, I would love to talk to Abraham Lincoln too, but you know, he's a common one, and
I don't mind that at all.
No, I wouldn't either. He's one of my, again, I respect him. I use a lot of his material, and then I love presidential history. I think I one of my strengths, and at one time I could list all of them in order and kind of their basics, but I would love to dive deeper and educate people more about Harry Truman. I mean, the only president that ever dropped the bomb, which is good and bad in people's life, but he did it, and he made that decision, which some of the things, the buck stops here with him for doing it, but he had the courage to make, whether it's right or wrong decision. So he intrigues me on some of his, he was a normal person. He was very honest from what I read, but anyway, my Harry Truman stories. But your homework is, I like it, Dedalia. The next time you two need to come up with a food question. But until then, go Stars.
Stars on Sports is recorded live at the WLNZ studio. Engineering and production assistance are provided by Dedalia Lowry, and you can listen to the episode and other episodes of Stars on Sports on demand at lccconnect.org. To find more information about our athletic program, visit lccstars.com. Thanks for listening. Be sure to join us next time for more Stars on Sports.
Go Stars!
Connected with LCC Connect at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Engaged learning and academic success is a priority at Lansing Community College. To help students navigate their educational career, LCC has created a proactive approach to learning and providing students with several academic support services. To find out what's available, visit lcc.edu/services.
Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Lansing Community College's Business and Community Institute provides businesses with customized synergistic trainings that realize logistical opportunity. Learn more about the future of business today at lcc.edu/BCI.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision. From the watchmen of ancient cities to the rise of modern police forces, and from medieval dungeons to today's correctional institutions, our systems of law enforcement and punishment have shaped societies for centuries. Welcome to Silver and Blue, tracing the history of policing and corrections, the podcast where we will uncover the beginning to the present of policing and corrections. Each episode will explore how justice was enforced, how punishment evolved, and what these legacies mean for us today. Let's step back in time and see how order, and disorder came to be. Welcome back to Silver and Blue, the podcast where we explore the origins of policing, law, and justice, from the earliest civilizations all the way to today's modern systems. I'm Tammy McDermott, and I'm your host. In our first episode, we traveled to Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, where humans first wrote down laws and experimented with the earliest forms of policing. Today, we're heading southwest to another ancient giant, Egypt, a civilization shaped not by unpredictable rivers, but by one extraordinarily predictable one, the Nile, a land where justice wasn't carved into stone tablets, but woven into the cosmic fabric of the universe, where maintaining order wasn't just a civic duty, it was considered a sacred one. In this episode, we'll explore how ancient Egyptian society was organized, what law meant in a world governed by the concept of mot, how officials enforced order across a kingdom stretching hundreds of miles, the roles of courts, judges, and scribes, crime and punishment, from theft to treason, and how Egyptian ideas of justice still echo in today's legal philosophies. So let's step back into the land of pharaohs, temples, and eternal principles and discover what justice meant along the banks of the Nile. What do you think of when you envision Egypt of this time? I see only what has been presented in movies like The Mummy, or Raiders of the Lost Ark, or even photos of Google or other social media. But the reality is even more extraordinary. So let's see why. Mesopotamia's rivers flooded violently and unpredictably. But the Nile? The Nile had a rhythm and regularity that you could compare to a heartbeat. And it stretched over 700 miles long. Every year, without fail, the floodwaters rose, deposited rich silt, and receded, leaving behind fertile black soil that was known to the native population as Kemet. This allowed everything about Egyptian life to grow and prosper. Things like stable agriculture. Knowing the cycle of the Nile allowed for the planting of crops and what crops would be good for each season. Long-lasting institutions. These are buildings that are still seen today. A centralized hierarchical government. A worldview that was built on balance and harmony. By around 3100 BCE, Egypt had unified under a single ruler, the pharaoh, and developed monumental architecture, architecture that still exists today, like the Pyramid of Giza, the Step Pyramid of Djoser, Valley of the Kings, the Great Sphinx, the Obelisk of Hatshepsut, and Thutmose III. Temples and priesthood, like the temple at Karnak, the temple of Philae, and if any of you have watched the Mummy movies, these are all featured and are amazing to see. I would recommend searching them if you haven't had a chance to see them. With this also came the use of hieroglyphs, the pictograph system of writing and communication that allowed for record keeping and documentation. With this, an administrative machine that emerged to manage a kingdom 700 miles long. To make sure that order would be the norm and not chaos, there needed to be a rule and a way to govern. But unlike Mesopotamia, Egypt did not begin with long written law codes. Instead, Egypt began with what was to them something deeper and arguably more powerful, mentioned at the start of the show, mot. So what is mot? Mot was the core idea behind Egyptian justice, believed to be the natural order that was established at creation. With this idea, the core of justice lay with the principle of truth, balance, harmony, and cosmic order. So I'm talking about thousands-year-old ideal that seems to have no connection to today, right? Well, not really. As we will see, the foundations of Mot were a moral ideal, a philosophy that would guide rules and decisions. And for ancient Egypt, it was the foundation of all law. To Egyptians, maintaining Mot was not just desirable, it was necessary for the universe to function. This meant that all people were meant to be truthful, act justly, and treat others fairly. Political order, social stability, and even the raising of the sun were understood to depend on it. Remember in our last episode that Mesopotamia left a stone carving with detailed legal codes. Think Hammurabi. Well, Egypt did not leave behind detailed legal codes. So how did we know how Egyptian law was carried out? Better yet, how were we able to find out about it? Well, it wasn't until hieroglyphs were finally deciphered in the 19th century that a peek into how ancient Egypt went about administering law, justice, and running such an expansive country. It wasn't until hieroglyphics were finally deciphered in the 19th century that a peek into how ancient Egypt went about administering. It wasn't until hieroglyphs were finally deciphered in the 19th century that a peek into ancient Egypt went about administering law, justice, and running such an expansive country. What was uncovered shows that nothing was written down like Hammurabi did, but shows that Egyptian law was based on precedent. That means what happened before and was established continues. Egyptian law was preserved in court records, decrees, and administrative texts. Hieroglyphs showed that officials were exceptional record keepers, and Egyptian law understood through Mat rather than codified statutes. And when it came to making decisions, the judges were expected to rule based on custom, so what had been established over generations, social norms, what society had determined to be expectations for people to abide by, prior cases. This goes back to the principle of precedent. And we'll talk a lot more about that as we creep closer to modern day, since this concept is still heavily relied on in today's global justice system. Royal decrees, remembering that the rulers at the time were a central figure that was given a title of royal significance. What he or she said was followed by all, and these decrees were sent down from the top to govern the masses. And the judges were then also ruled based on ethical principles that were tied to Mat. But the absence of a rigid, written down, or in this case, chiseled, or inked on papyrus code does not mean Egypt lacked structure. The leader in ancient Egypt was the pharaoh. And the pharaoh wasn't just a king. And if you have seen any movie that was based about Egypt, pharaohs don't look like our vision of a king. But that was the point. He was the earthly guardian of Mat. His job wasn't simply to rule. It was to maintain cosmic balance in society through good governance, fair rulings, and care for the vulnerable. So when it came down to it, Egypt's legal system was highly bureaucratic, not too different from the way things are today. So when we get done breaking it down, we will revisit things and you can decide. So let's break it down. First up was in the handling of all affairs, and this was done by the vizier. Now, this was considered the chief justice or the pharaoh's right-hand guy. He was the highest official under the pharaoh, and this meant he oversaw national administration, which, if you think about it, had to have been a hefty job with 700 miles of territory to officiate over. He looked over taxation, public works. Now tell me, can you imagine trying to make sure the roads, construction, maintenance, etc., all over 700 miles of Egypt? I don't. He oversaw courts and legal disputes, and he also oversaw the state archives. And if this hadn't been done, can you imagine what we would never know? The place that the vizier held court was the Hall of Mat, and this is where he heard his cases and issued judgments. Under the vizier came the regional governors. These were called nomarchs. With Egypt being as mammoth as it was, they divided it into districts called nomes. Each district or nome had a governor who handled local disputes, tax duties, I think tax collector, maintaining order. You know, that those people who won't get along all the time, that's like any society. And overseeing scribes and officials. This was to ensure accurate records were kept. With these nomarchs, think state government in Egyptian clothing. At the bottom, so to speak, were the village elders and the local courts. This was considered the lowest level, made of small councils of elders and scribes that handled everyday conflicts. This shows that they oversaw land boundaries, inheritance, worker conflicts, theft, and marriage issues. For our analogy purposes, think your local city council or village council, along with the district courts. The last part of the bureaucracy would be the scribes. These are people that I believe were some of the most important people of this time. Nothing happened without a scribe. This group were the backbone of Egyptian bureaucracy. Why, you ask? I'll tell you. The scribes were responsible for documenting all complaints, testimonies, judgments, contracts, property transfers. For the society at this time was essential to keep accurate records for everything to run. For us in our time, they were just as important for completely different reasons. Without the scribes of ancient Egypt, there would be no knowledge of this time. Their records allow modern scholars to reconstruct Egyptian life following the deciphering of the hieroglyphics. So now that we have the backbone and we know how Egypt was run, we can get into who enforced the law. This was Egypt's first police personnel. They were known as the Medjay. Originally a Nubian desert people, the Medjay became the elite police force under the Middle and New Kingdoms. Their main responsibilities included desert patrols. Think about that duty with all but nothing of desert. Tomb guards, making sure no one raided the tombs. City police, even 3,000 to 5,000 years ago, a land like Egypt had bustling cities. Palace security, military scouts. The next were temple guards. Temples held wealth and land, so they employed guards to prevent theft, trespassing, and unauthorized access. Then you had your court enforcement officials. They executed any court judgments, so think bailiffs and sheriffs. They also had community responsibility. Think back to Mesopotamia, where they also had the concept of community responsibility. Egyptian villages were expected to report crimes and identify offenders. Entire groups could be held responsible if they sheltered a criminal. Remember I talked about scribes? There is police evidence on papyrus. Now, papyrus was the paper of their time, and they were deciphered from tablets found and also documents that had information on papyrus. Some of the evidence: interrogation transcripts, theft investigations, reports on missing property, and fugitive lists. So once we had all of the police and the reports, how were the courts of this time? Egyptian trials were surprisingly normal. Courts could include the vizier, remember, top guy, local governors or the nomarchs, priests, military officials, elders, and of course the scribes. The evidence that was often considered at these court trials, witness testimony, written contracts, oaths, physical examination of property, confessions, and prior precedents. Does any of this seem familiar? As you can see, many of what occurred in ancient Egypt occurs today. Oaths were taken very seriously. Swearing falsely wasn't just illegal, it was considered a violation of Maat. So why does Egyptian law matter? Why are we talking about this today? Because Egypt represents a completely different model of justice from Mesopotamia. Where Mesopotamia used written codes, Egypt used ethical philosophy. Where Mesopotamia saw law as a contract, Egypt saw it as a cosmic duty. And where Mesopotamia carved rules into stone, Egypt carved principles into culture. Ancient Egypt showed us a world where balance outranked punishment, ethics outranked technicalities, and truth wasn't just legal, it was sacred. And the questions Egyptians asked remain ours today. How do we maintain harmony in a diverse society? How do we balance authority with fairness? And what role should morality play in law? Lastly, how do we build systems that preserve justice across generations? Thank you for joining me today. In our next episode, we'll leave the Nile behind and travel to ancient Greece, where democracy, courts, and citizen juries shaped a new understanding of legal responsibility. That wraps up today's episode of Silver and Blue, tracing the history of policing and corrections. This podcast is produced by LCC Connect. You can listen to other podcasts in the LCC Connect family by going to lccconnect.com. If you want to listen to this podcast on demand, go to lccconnect.com and visit the Silver and Blue webpage. Until next time, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep the dialogue alive.
This is WLNZ, Lansing. You're listening to LCC Connect Weekly, a radio program from Lansing Community College's podcast network, LCC Connect. We feature more than 30 podcasts that explore education, culture, community, and our connection to the world. To listen on demand, find us at lccconnect.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.